Thanks very much, Marla. As Marla said, it is our absolute pleasure to invite and to have accepted Alex Heath to come and talk with us here in Tasmania. Alex will be talking tomorrow to our group of high school students as part of our drive to ensure that high school students get an opportunity to understand what economics might be about and what it can offer for them in the future. So Alex and I have known each other for probably 25 years or so now. We didn't have to bring that up. But she's quite pleased to know that she can still say that she did join the Reserve Bank after me, so she still gets to be younger than I am, so that's good. She joined the bank in about 92 after finishing her honours graduate degree in University of Sydney. But she was a cadet at the RBA during her honours graduate program. She's been at the RBA almost all of the time since then, except for a stint at the Bank for International Settlements, but she's held quite a large number of positions throughout a broad spectrum of the aspects that the Reserve Bank covers, including being the head of research from 2012 to 2014, and currently the head of economic analysis, which is one of the reasons you will see lots of speeches from Alex in the RBA's website, because that's one of the roles of people who are head of economic analysis. She holds a PhD from LSE, and she's an excellent economist. Any of you who've seen her in action, either on the press or have been lucky enough to be at conferences where Alex is speaking, will know that she has at her fingertips a wealth of information and is able to bring that to bear on any question that is aimed at her and contribute to the discussion in a way that is both informed and informational for the audience. So I think she's a great role model for us as to what we can achieve in mainstream economics as females and also just as economists. I think Alex is not just a role model for us as a female economist, Alex is a role model for us as a macro policy making economist. And so I'd invite her to give her presentation. Thanks very much.
So I fear Marty might have raised the bar too high, so we'll see how we go. It's an absolute pleasure to be here in Tasmania, to be here in Hobart. I haven't actually been to the University of Tasmania for a little while, but I've certainly been to Tasmania frequently as a visitor. One of our board meetings was here last year, and it's a great place to come in summer to go walking, I have to say. It's a great pleasure as well to be here as a part of a Women in Economics Network event. This is something that got off the ground surprisingly quickly, and I've been pretty impressed with the extent to which people have put energy into it and how enthusiastically people have embraced it. So there does seem to be a real need for a bit of advocacy in terms of saying, you know, females have a valuable role to play as part of economics. I think every discipline benefits from diversity. Gender is one aspect of diversity. There are a lot of aspects of diversity, and we shouldn't forget that. I do feel a little bit nervous when the word role model does get used, because I wonder quietly whether my experience is really so representative that other people could look at me and think, oh, that's what I would like to do. And I also worry a little bit that you want to make sure you're not limited by what you can see. So if I can encourage people to think big by being a role model, that's great, but don't be limited by, you know, what I've done or what I've seen, because there are so many things out there that I haven't done and I haven't been involved with, and there are opportunities for the rest of you. Okay, so to today's talk. The title's not as catchy as it could have been, but what I want to talk about is the role of business services as a part of structural change in Australia. And one of the reasons that the title started the way it did was it started as a slightly broader question, and as we did more work on it, we really started to notice quite how important what was happening in business services was for what we were trying to talk about. So at the heart of the question is trying to understand the structural changes that have occurred in Australia over time. So there's been a lot of them, and one of the most pronounced and persistent changes has been the shift from a goods-producing economy towards a more services-oriented economy. So Australians are producing more services, we're consuming more services, and we're trading more services with other countries than we have ever done in the past. And this trend is pretty broadly apparent no matter where you look. And so in the case of Tasmania, I think the role of tourism is a really prominent example of how important service, the growth in services can be for a local economy. So one of the reasons why there has been this shift towards services in a service-based economy in Australia is that households have experienced a remarkable growth in their incomes. So some of this has been because Australia has more or less experienced uninterrupted growth for 25 years. And real income per household has more than doubled since the early 1960s. And we know that as incomes rise, households tend to spend more of their income on services, so things like health, education and restaurant meals, and a smaller share of their income is spent on goods. So the absolute amount being spent might be similar, but the share shrinks. But what I want to talk more about today is the role of business services. So what's been very clear also is that demand for business services has increased over time. And I'm going to focus on the fundamental ways in which the business services, the fundamental changes in the way the business services industry interact with other industries in the economy, and what this might tell us about the broader Australian story. In summary, businesses that produce goods and distribute goods have become more specialised, and so they've focused much more on producing what are their core activities, and they've increasingly outsourced their non-core activities to the business service sector. So some of this reorganisation has been possible because of technological change. So things as simple as the ability to communicate and the complexity of the logistics of doing things across firms has been reduced by technological change. And technological change has allowed a whole lot of processes to be automated, which has also contributed. So some outsourcing, it is true, has just changed the industry where the activity is recorded as having been done. But at the same time, there's been a whole lot of new business services introduced into the economy as time has gone by. And the outsourcing of business services to dedicated providers, we should expect, will deliver efficiency gains. And I'll show you some information later that suggests that, in fact, there is some evidence that this has been happening. And there's also evidence from the labour market that suggests that what's the changing nature of business services is actually quite different to the way employment is changing for other sectors of the economy. And I think collectively what this suggests is that business services are pretty much at the centre of how technological change is transforming the Australian economy. So, no good presentation from the Reserve Bank doesn't have a graph. So the fact that business services have become a more important part of economic activity in Australia is a pretty well-known fact. The business services sector has increased as a share of gross value added in the economy from less than 20% in the early 1990s to more than 25% today. And broadly speaking, the business service sector captures any firm that provides some sort of service or some kind of assistance to other firms. So there's a whole range of things that we would traditionally think of that fall into this category, things like legal advice, accounting services, but there's a whole range of less traditional things that live in this category as well. So things like management consulting, internet providers, and computer system design are also classified as business services. So at the same time as business services have been increasing as a share of the economy, the goods production sector has been a decreasing share of the gross value added in the economy. So this is sectors that include pretty much encompass manufacturing, mining and construction. And so their share has declined at pretty much to a similar degree. So some of this increase in demand for business services has come about because people have, or firms have reorganised activity. And as I've mentioned before, as they become more specialised in areas of comparative advantage, they're more likely to outsource some activities that are not their comparative advantage. So things like cleaning services, catering services and some administrative functions. And so they tend to outsource these to more specialised providers, even if the nature of the service being delivered hasn't really changed. Technological change, as I said, has played a role in this because the cost of communicating across firms, the cost of managing logistics across firms, the cost of just dealing with things across that boundary have been reduced by technological change. And I think the technological progress has meant that over time the scope and complexity of what can be outsourced has increased. Technological change has also enabled the development of entirely new ways to deliver these services, and in particular in cases where specialist knowledge is required. So an example of this is IT-based systems that are designed to automate office processes. So that typically requires a fairly significant investment, and it can be very difficult for an individual firm to justify that sort of investment, especially if they're small. Even in a situation where they're expecting to get huge efficiency gains from automating a process. So that's a case where it makes sense to purchase that service from a provider who specialises in the design of IT systems so that they can take advantage of economies of scale and deliver that one service to a whole range of different users. So there's a lot of ways to look at how technological change might have played a role. So I'm going to start by looking at how the definitions and measurements of industries has changed over time. So if we go back to 1962-63, the national accounts had information on 69 different manufacturing categories and only 6 business service categories. More recently, the national accounts data only cover 51 manufacturing categories, and the number of business service categories has increased to 16. Later this year, the ABS is planning to release data that splits out computer systems design and related services from the professional, scientific and technical services industry for the first time. So this is one case where the role of technological change is pretty easily identified. Another example is communication services. So if you go back 50 years, communication services included postal, courier and telecommunication services. Now there's an industry called information, media and telecommunications, and all those things are contained within that, but it's a much broader category that also includes internet publishing and broadcasting, internet service providers and web search portals and data processing services. So you can see that the definitions are showing how the technological change is showing up in industry structure. Another way to understand how this reorganisation of Australian industries is occurring is to look at input-output tables. So what input-output tables are, they're created by the Australian Bureau of Statistics, the ABS, as a part of the system of national accounts. And what they do is provide information on what value is added by different industries at different points in the production process. And to do this, they, well, the way they do this is they allow the value of the intermediate inputs that go into a particular industry to be subtracted from the value that that industry produces. So you can get the gross value that's added by that industry. So what this graph shows is how much additional demand for intermediate inputs there will be for one extra dollar's worth of production in the goods production sector. So this is mining, manufacturing and construction. So the additional demand that one extra dollar of goods production generates for household services and the goods distribution sector has basically been constant over time, or it's been relatively stable over time. But the additional demand for intermediate inputs from the business services sector has increased quite significantly. So it's gone from being roughly nothing about 50 years ago to about 20 cents for every dollar of output today. So this is consistent with the observation that technological change has enabled goods production firms to become more specialised in their core activities and outsource their other services to the business services sector. So this graph shows the amount of intermediate inputs demanded from the business services sector for every dollar produced by business services, goods distribution, goods production, and household services. And what's interesting about this graph is that it shows that business services have become more important as an intermediate input for all the sectors of the economy, including the business services sector itself. Okay, so this basically is telling us a story that business services are becoming increasingly integrated with other sectors of the economy. And this is consistent with evidence that we have that the supply chains in modern economies are getting longer. So there's a fairly significant literature that tells us that documented the lengthening of global supply chains as production has become more fragmented across economies. So the classic example here is the iPhone and how the production process of the iPhone crosses a very large number of countries. Recent work at the Reserve Bank of Australia has also documented the lengthening of supply chains within Australia. There's a number of different ways to measure supply chains. So one of them is to ask the question, what's the average number of stages between the production of a given sector and it ending up as a piece of final demand? So this is a measure known as upstreamness. It measures how upstream in the production process a sector is. So this graph shows calculations of upstreamness for the four different sectors I looked at before, and it confirms that business services have become increasingly important as intermediate inputs into the production of other sectors. And another thing that's interesting to note is that household services is, unsurprisingly, one of the most downstream industries of the economy because it's very close to final demand. Another very common measure of the length of a supply chain is known as fragmentation. So instead of looking at how many stages are there between production and final demand, it asks the question of how many stages are involved before you get to the production of a certain sector's goods. And it takes into account what value is added at each stage in that process. So this is a graph that shows measures of fragmentation for the four different sectors. And it shows that the goods production sector is the most fragmented sector because it uses the most intermediate inputs. Business services and household services are the least fragmented sectors of the economy, which indicate they use fewer intermediate inputs. But the increase in fragmentation that you can see across all sectors over time, particularly before the 2000s, is consistent with all the other evidence that I've shown about the lengthening of supply chains in the economy. So the question is, if we've had all this reorganisation of activity across industry as a result of specialisation, increased returns to scale, more efficient organisation of activities across firms, what we should expect to see is that multi-factor productivity increases in periods of time when supply chains are increasing. If we have increasing integration across sectors as a result of longer supply chains, that should also boost MFP, multi-factor productivity growth, because it should make it easier to get to share technologies and productivity gains across sectors. So this is my favourite graph. I have to, as a general statement, it's extraordinarily difficult to find it's very difficult to attribute changes in productivity to any one given causing factor as a general rule. But what this graph shows is that there actually does appear to be a correlation between growth in MFP and periods of time where supply chains are lengthening. So here we've got measures of upstreamness and fragmentation for the economy as a whole. So I wouldn't want to overemphasize the message of this graph, but at the very least, this graph suggests that there's a huge amount more work that could be done productively by investigating this sort of relationship at the firm level data, at the firm level of data. And we do have the opportunity to do that now with things like the ABS's Blade database, which is a firm-level data set that actually does provide us with the sorts of information we would need to unpick this sort of high-level correlation. So another source of information about the way structural change is occurring in the Australian economy and the part played by business services is the labour market. As most people who followed my speeches will know, sooner or later there will be something about the labour market. So the literature suggests that the reorganisation of activity associated with the lengthening of supply chains has led to a shift towards more skilled labour, and that this trend has actually been a lot more apparent and pronounced in advanced economies such as Australia. More generally, there's a growing body of literature that shows technological change in the form of advances in computer technology have been an important driver of the shift from routine to non-routine jobs. The evidence for Australia that's been available so far does suggest that this is true for Australia. So it is true that there's been more creation of non-routine jobs at the same time as growth in routine jobs has been less, well, there has been very little in the way of routine job growth. But there's also evidence the effects of technological change in Australia hasn't picked up. So we're not living in unusual times at this point in time, that perhaps this is just a part of the sort of technological change that's been occurring over several decades. So the data for Australia show that people employed in the business services sector has almost doubled since the 1960s to be almost 20% of the workforce in 2016. And this graph shows that most of the growth over a shorter time period in employment in business services has indeed been in the non-routine cognitive category, which is exactly what you would expect if technological change was an important driver of developments in the business services sector. Another interesting point is from this graph is that similar forces appear to have been at work in the household services sector. So the household services sector has actually generated more growth than any of the other four sectors put together, and almost all of that has been in either non-routine cognitive work, but somewhat differently to the business services sector. It's also generated a lot of demand for non-routine manual work. Another perspective on this can be gained by looking at data on what specific skills and abilities are required in the business services sector and how that's changed over time. So this can be done by using very detailed data on what skills and abilities are required by different occupations and then combining that with information on how demand for different occupations has changed over time in the different sectors of the economy. So, an example is systems analysis. So this is one of the skills that has become increasingly important in the economy as time has gone by. This graph shows that systems analysis as a skill has been more important in the business services sector than the other sectors of the economy for as long as we have available data. But what's particularly interesting is that the importance of that skill has increased quite significantly in business services since the mid-1990s. And while it's increased in importance for these other sectors of the economy, it hasn't been nearly to the same degree. And what's really interesting when you get into these data, and there's actually information in the footnotes about what we've done exactly, I didn't want to bore you with those details, it doesn't really matter what sorts of skills and abilities you choose, you get a very similar story. So this is a very busy graph, but basically it's the top right-hand panel is the one I just showed you, but it shows for a range of higher level cognitive skills and abilities, the business services sector has been increasingly using them, and that most of the increase in their importance has come through the business service sector rather than other sectors of the economy. So the automatic question that gets asked is, well, if that's increasing in importance, what's decreasing in importance? And the answer to that is it tends to be more physical skills, so things like coordination and manual dexterity. So bringing all that together, I think collectively the evidence suggests that the business services sector has been a very important part of the way that the economy has been responding to technological change. And in the process of this, business services have become more important, they've become more specialised, and they've become a lot more integrated with other sectors of the economy. And I think there's also some intriguing evidence that suggests that this has also been associated with higher productivity growth. Data from the labour market also support the idea that business service industries are at the heart of how technological change is transforming the structure of the Australian economy. But I think quite a lot more work needs to be done to fully understand what's happening here. So we really do need to gain a better understanding of exactly how this technological change is affecting the economy through these channels and how it's likely that developments of this kind will affect productivity growth into the future. So that was all I had to say on business services. So I'm more than happy to take questions. I don't know if you're going to moderate that or...
So thank you very much, Alex. So if you would like to ask Alex a question, as she's kindly said that she would take some, then please, if you could stand and say your name so people Alex knows where you're from, and ask a question clearly so that the mic can pick it up, would be great.
And they don't have to be constrained to the presentation.
No, you can ask lots of questions. You probably can't ask her what the exchange rate's going to be or the interest rate will be next month's policy committee meeting, but yeah, other than that, I think she's pretty happy to field questions.
Absolutely.
Hello, it's Graham Wood. On your measures of productivity, this is probably a built-up question, but
only
outsourcing in some service sectors is really involved outsourcing to the non-price household. So for those of us who spend hours waiting to get through a telephone queue, or you know, doing online stuff, that's not measured.
Correct.
Is there any data on that, or any timely surveys? That I would have said has become more important over time.
Yep.
So do you have any data on that?
The short answer is we don't have good data on that, and I think you raise the outsourcing of business services to the household sector because you have to do a lot more work on the when you're in the phone to get to the right place rather than having a person on the other end of the line. Another area where this question about measurement and household services and business services comes into play are questions around how should we measure the service being provided by somebody renting out their house using Airbnb, because that's a margin where at some deep level it's always been thought of as a household, but now some part of what was a household service is being delivered as a business service in some cases. So the answer is, the short answer is we don't have good measurement. But I would point out that another very interesting trend is that a whole lot of production that used to happen in the household sector has actually been formalised and in the form of the household services. So if you look at some of the subcategories that have grown particularly strongly, it's things like aged care workers, childcare workers. So we do actually have good measurement of what things are moving out of, are not being measured in the informal sector, but are moving into the formal sector, but we don't have a very good way of kind of measuring how things are working in reverse. And I think you're right, I think it would be detailed time use surveys that we would need to be able to do that. And as far as I'm aware, we haven't got a recent time use survey that would allow us to do that for Australia.
Industries and the contribution that the industry to the economy. about the commission because David is in the finance for web, website, API,
yep.
So a lot of professionals could do the original written expression that we could use a creative definition. So it's all, so whether the technological factor is actually also pushing the creative sector, people which before it was manufacturing or mining or the resource sector or the performance one, whether these services are coming also from the community perspective or the professional perspective. So the technological change feeding into creative.
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of aspects of that. So in terms of the measurement, you're right, things like architecture would fall into business services, but actually the arts, so very literally taken, things like going to the opera and art galleries would actually be classified as a household service. And I think one of the interesting, so when I set out to do this speech, I had actually thought I would be talking about how the manufacturing sector has changed. And what's really interesting there is, in Australia, there's quite a sizable sort of what you would describe as a niche manufacturing sector. So there's a lot of creative input, a lot of intellectual capital, that, and all, a lot of the design side of things happens in Australia. But then the production element of it tends to get outsourced overseas. So what a manufacturing industry looks like in Australia is much less likely to be a factory now than a much more creative space where people are coming up with the original ideas. And so in a composition terms, I think it's true that because of outsourcing and because of dividing up the supply chain across a whole range of different countries as well, means that what we have in the goods production sector is probably a lot more creative than what we're thinking about when we kind of have a picture of the manufacturing sector. So it is it's another force that's operating.
In terms of your fantastic graph showing the change in the sectors and the GDP growth, what do you think?
GDP growth or productivity growth?
Productivity growth, right? Yes.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yep.
What do you think are the policy levers that are or what might drive that change that you're seeing there, and then how might that relate to the policy levers that either the Reserve Bank or sort of fiscal policy or policy what do you think might be the driving that pretty massive structural change there in the relationship?
Yeah, so I guess the first point I would just re-emphasise is a correlation, and it's an intrigue. So the way I set the graph up was, wouldn't it be amazing if we got a graph that showed that there was a correlation between these two things, and we drew the graph, and as any of you who've been applied economists know, that you don't often get something looking better than what you expect. In terms of policy levers, I don't think, we're really dealing with long-term structural trends, so that takes it out of the space where the Reserve Bank would really have relevant policy levers, because ultimately things like monetary policy are sort of business cycle focused. So the message to take away from it is, when you're getting structural change and it is leading to reorganisation of industries and where things are allocated, it does seem to have a positive productivity effect. So I guess in the current context, the question is, well, how is technology transforming things? And there are a lot of debates about where the margins are between, should Uber and Airbnb are kind of right on the edge of that, for example. Is that something we should let happen? Or is that something that we should feel quite nervous about? And I think the answer is, in a long-term sense, you have to take advantage of technological change to get the productivity growth, but you also have to be conscious that it can be a disruptive process. So I think one of the lessons from the labour market information that I sort of touched on really is that technological change really does create new jobs, but there are other jobs that become obsolete. So there's a real margin question about how do you make sure that the people who lose their jobs in that process are in a position to retrain and get the new jobs. So I think it's hard to come up with a specific policy recommendation, but I think it would be try to understand what sorts of changes are happening and try not to get in the way unnecessarily, but to be aware that there are things there are consequences of that may need to be managed. And maybe it's my personal bias and interest in labour markets, but I would say that's certainly one of the areas that people in state governments and the federal government should be paying a lot of attention to.
It is my privilege as chair to say, do you think that these changes that you mentioned, especially have struck by the 1960s to now, have made the economy more robust or less robust? Should we be more worried from macro or less worried from macro? So if I take some of the most recent literature that kind of implies that the tail wags the dog, you know, it's firm level shocks that transmit up and cause volatility at macroeconomic level. Should
I be worried about longer supply chains as I'm worried about stability, or should I be thinking that this is actually making every unit smaller and more? I think there's probably offsetting forces at play. So my natural reference point, and I'm suspecting yours, is sort of the financial stability literature. So a more distributed system tends to be more robust to distributed shocks. Because if one piece of it is affected, the rest of it can kind of work around that, but they tend not to be as robust to correlated shocks. So I think this is one of the things that you would want to understand at that firm level debt level much more effectively, because I think this is intriguing, but it doesn't really explain what's happening and why it's happening at the firm level, and ultimately that's what your question requires, is information. And what exactly are these interactions? Is it sort of, is it that some of those business services firms are just providing services to one employer or one goods production sector firm, for example, or is it like the IT provider example where I'm producing a solution that I can sell to a very large number of different firms, in which case I'm going to be reasonably insulated from a specific shock? So I think the answer to the question really requires more information on what's happening at the firm level. But it...
More work, that's always good.
Well, yes, more work, but, you know, I think some of this is about what are the right questions that we should be asking. When it comes to productivity growth, it's a fundamentally important thing. That's sort of where the welfare of the Australian people comes from. That's one of the core pieces of the RBA's mandate. So we do need to understand it better, and we have the Productivity Commission, we've got the recent information from the Treasury. So this is a really important question, and I guess what I'm flagging here is that maybe this is an area that we haven't paid a lot of attention to that deserves more research. And who knows, we may be able to create network graphs and based on firm level data, and we can actually be more specific about this question about resilience. But I think the thing that's interesting about productivity is when you go into the literature where people are trying to understand what drives productivity, one of the things that works quite differently is that often the question is, well, we've seen computers become integrated in everyday office activities, so why is it that we can't see a boost to productivity growth? So it tends to be that the dividends are much longer term and it takes a really long time to see the benefits rather than the other way around, seeing them very quickly and perhaps not finding it in the longer run.
More questions?
Now, we talk about specialization, but it's also got to do with cross-country.
Yes.
So how does this position, or how would you explain that?
So there are data available, so there's international input-output tables. So what you can do is, I've really just restricted myself to looking at the Australian case, but you can actually ask questions about, well, if the production of my sector becomes an input to a sector in another country, which then becomes an input to a sector in a third country, how does that all show up? And so actually the Reserve Bank work that I referred to is a research discussion paper that looks at that question. And, one of the conclusions was that in an international sense, Australia's actually become more upstream. And that at some fundamental level has a lot to do with the fact that a lot of our exports are mining exports that become inputs into other people's production sectors. From memory, these international input-output tables are actually not available in that sort of post-mining boom period to sort of know how that's changed. But, I mean, all the things that I've talked about here fundamentally can be done in an international context. But another conclusion of that paper that I've found quite interesting, and it was sort of obvious when you saw it but somehow isn't until you see it, when we look at trade, we're not netting at, it's not a value-added concept. If we sort of add the trade that I do with China and then the trade that China does with the US, we're not actually measuring the value-added along that process. We're just adding it up as a gross concept. So anyway, that can deliver some interesting insights as well. Yep. So I've actually done some other work looking at this. The connection with wages is also related to supply. So, at the same time as this process of increasing demand for, say, non-routine cognitive jobs is occurring, we also have had a significant expansion in tertiary education. So the supply of people with the sorts of qualifications that match this demand has also been increasing. So basically you would expect wage growth to be stronger in situations where there was more demand than supply. And so there are actually some business services where it's been much more equal than others. So at this particular instant in time, for example, we have a liaison program where we talk to businesses to try and understand what's happening on the ground, as it were. And when it comes to wage growth, one of the kind of big macro questions that we have is, why has wage growth declined the way it has? When we understand that, maybe we've got a better way of forecasting how we should expect wage growth to evolve going forward. And one of the things we find is that there are pockets of in quite rapid wage growth, but it tends to be in things like IT security and cloud computing services, where there's a huge amount of demand, but the supply of graduates and the supply of experience hasn't kept up. But it's not so true for, I hesitate to sort of pick out a very specific example, but like legal services, for example. That's actually an area where there's been a huge increase in supply, so that hasn't had as much in the way of wage consequences. And I think this is a bit of an aside, but on the non-routine manual side for the household services, that's an interesting one because growth in wages there has not been very strong. And one of the explanations for that is that the supply of people who can do those jobs has also been quite significant.
More questions?
Run them out.
Okay, so I... Sorry, didn't...
Phil Fisher was coming out and talked about Phil Wayne's role. Do you think it is of the secretary, public secretary, private secretary?
So we haven't done that. So basically what we can do is, as long as you can identify the public sector as an industry, so there is a public administration industry, so you can look at the linkages and interrelationships between that industry and other industries, so you can cut it in a slot. This is a reasonably aggregated view. So the answer is we could look at whether that's different, but we haven't looked at whether that's different. So I can't answer the question. But I will go back and ask ask some people to have a look at it. Yeah, so the extent to which this is... So I have looked at it, maybe not as in that exact... So just sort of going back to this point about tertiary education. So one of the things that has been really important for women's participation in the workforce is access to tertiary education and participation in tertiary education. So for both males and females, participation has increased. But for females, the increase has been greater. So it is quite interesting if you sort of compare things to the 1980s. There's sort of three occupations that have become distinctly more even. So they were quite male-dominated and have become relatively equal. And the three that stood out to me from memory were law, medicine and accounting, actually. So these are three areas where females have been able to take advantage of their tertiary education and gain employment. But interestingly, there are some sectors that have become more male-dominated over time and some that have become more female-dominated. So, for example, vet apparently has become more female-dominated, whereas IT, remarkably, has become more male-dominated over time. So the question about how all this plays out is, I think you have to kind of almost go a little bit lower into the, you know, deeper into the question and ask, well, so what's motivating women to go and do accounting, law and medicine and vet, for example, but not to go into IT and, as we've discussed about economics, certainly at the high school level, there's been the attrition of females doing economics has been much more significant than the attrition for males. So I think there's a real question about where how these choices are being made and what's influencing them, because it's working quite differently in different sectors of the economy.